Hey there, everybody. Welcome to, I'm not sure if it's a bonus episode or if it's a regular old episode of the Hugo's There podcast, but I'm joined by a couple people that I know through various ways, but I know both of these people through the Nebulugo Book Club on Discord, and you have heard J.W. Wartick before. Hey, J.W.
Hello.
Yeah, good to have you. And then we also have Sophia from the Book Club. Hi, Sophia.
Hi, everyone.
Yes, and she's somebody that I've actually met in person because she's another Portlander. What happened here is normally I plan things out way in advance, but occasionally a book will somehow slide into my consciousness and I'll pick it up. And lots of times those books, I give a little thumb through and then I go, yeah, I got other stuff I got to read. But sometimes they're things that I just rip right through. And it happened that this one, after I did that, won the Locus Award. And so I thought, you know what? This is totally fair game to do an episode about. At first I was thinking it would be a bonus episode because I didn't know it was up for any awards. But now that it's a Locus winner, it's totally fair game. And the book is The Man Who Saw Seconds by Alexander Baldassare. So I don't remember, JW, you got to correct me. Did you come to this one first or did I recommend it to you?
You said that you had read it after it had won the Locus because I was like, I haven't even heard of this. And since you just said that, I didn't realize that you'd read it before it won the Locus. And I'm curious, how did you hear about it? Because I hadn't heard of it at all.
I don't remember how I heard of it because I don't think that because it only won the Locus a couple of weeks ago, right?
That's
right. And I read it a couple, like 6 weeks ago. So somehow it came across my radar. I think it was just on some list that I, like in an email or something from Book Riot or someplace that I got the recommendation. I'll try and trace down how it came across my radar. But why don't we talk about a little bit about, actually, Sophia, anything mm-hmm. people should know about you? Everybody knows JW already.
I like to read. No shock. I honestly feel like I read an average amount. And then when I talk to people not in this book club and sort of the general population, I realize that I am definitely in a rare, rarefied air.
Yeah.
By reading one book a week. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And when you're not comparing yourself with JW, that sounds like a lot. I mean, how did you come to science fiction and fantasy?
I have always enjoyed science fiction. I think of all the genres, it's always been my favorite. I think fantasy is a newer genre for me. And I wouldn't say I'm terribly picky, but I have. And I don't generally, you know, put books down without finishing them. But yeah, there's something to me that taps this like imagination, possible future, longing that really speaks to me.
Nice, so, nice.
Yeah.
For a long time, I was somebody who was like, you know, I'm not a quitter. I started this book, I'm going to finish it. And there was just a couple books that I read where I was like, nope, I need to be able to DNF stuff, yeah. Especially after going through the whole thing with the podcast and having to read them in order to, because I didn't feel like I could fairly talk about how I hated this book if I didn't finish it. Which that rarely happened, though. Most of the stuff I liked. So I'm on record with the stuff that I didn't love. But yeah, this book. JW, you want to kind of tackle the elevator pitch for it? What is this book actually about?
Sure.
And why was it so interesting to me?
Yeah. Well, I guess I don't know why it was so interesting to you. But so Man Who Saw Seconds, the title basically says what the premise is, which is that Preble Jefferson is a man who can see 5 seconds in the future. And it doesn't explain immediately why. I assume we'll have some sort of spoiler section later to talk about that. But
yeah.
It starts off, he's just, you know, had a chess game with his friend, Fish, who's a lawyer from an Eastern European country, very distrustful of the government. And immediately, like, he gets on a subway, you know, cracks a smile the wrong way for this group of police officers, ends up in an altercation with them that leads to death, and a lot of chase scenes ensue. And
a suspicious number of leg wounds.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well. Yes. And it becomes clear both through what he says in this very early scene, basically saying like, hey, if you bring weapons and start trying to shoot me, like people are going to get hurt, but not me. And, you know, people just watching the video and seeing afterwards what happened, it becomes clear that like, yeah, this guy can some sort of like, the observers are seeing something weird is happening. And so higher up levels of government and black ops get involved. And basically just trying to like track him down, catch him, because whether they think he's a rogue agent or whether they think that he's just a danger to society, they want to get him under control. And so if you kind of imagine a sort of like Bourne chase scene extended, that is a large part of the novel. It does evolve into quite a bit more than that later on. And again, I'm not sure how many spoilers we want to get into, but just to put it in the elevator pitch style, which is already too long for an elevator pitch, this turns much bigger picture than you might think based on the cover and based on the premise. It's not just a chase novel. It's not just a guy who sees in the future can escape from things. It turns into a much bigger picture, like threat to world order type of level. So,
yeah. No, that's good. And, you know, like some of the stuff that happens is that observers of it are like, that looks staged, right? It looks choreographed in some way. And so that's why it draws attention.
Yeah. So there's like that extended, like back and forth. I want to say it's Thad Bigman, you know, very, very subtle name there with who's from the government. It's sort of like this black ops guy. I forget what agency he's from.
I think it's NSA, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, he's kind of like, hey, like, why are all these cops in on this coordinated, you know, choreographed scene? And then it's like, well, it doesn't make sense that they'd be able to shoot this many bullets and miss in just quite this way. Even if they were trying, someone would goof it up, typically.
Yeah, so, and like going frame by frame, and like he moved before the shot was fired, right?
Yep.
And that's exactly where it starts to get to suspicious. But yeah, I mean, it's not even a spoiler to say that you can see 5 seconds, right? It's
title. Right there.
Yep. And it just front loads all of that kind of stuff. But then throughout the rest of the book, it pulls on it just a little bit. What does that mean? So Sophia, you came to this one on the book club thing, I think on JW's recommendation, which was off of mine, I think.
Yeah. And I, you know, so much gets recommended and I want to read everything. I want to read all the things. Mm-hmm. But I do generally enjoy time travel novels because I love seeing how people handle, you know, all the different things that break time travel. Mm-hmm. So the idea that you can see 5 seconds feels like nothing. But mm-hmm. the way it's framed in this book, you can tell like, oh, it's actually pretty significant to be able to see 5 seconds. And maybe even a minute or an hour or a day is like too overpowering. So I liked how, you know, there were definitely some things that, oh, 5 seconds, you know, can you really do that in 5 seconds? I'm not answering your original question. That's so okay. Yeah, I found
that's how we do things here.
So I found it on the Discord, and a lot of times it's a timing thing, like if I can get it from the library, and if it if it draws me in the first couple of pages, then I'm committed.
Right. Yeah, and in terms of the way this one flows, it does draw you right in, right? Because there's an opening conversation between two people, and then he's on the subway, and everything kicks off, and it just boom. It's kind of all go for a little while there. Yeah. And JW mentioned that he plays chess, and I think the variant he plays is like speed chess, right? Because that suits his ability.
Yeah, and does he say that he does chess boxing, or does he like box separately?
That's right. It was chess boxing. I forgot about that.
not with his friend Fish. At least I don't think they chess box. They play regular chess. But and part of the premise of that is that they can set the timer longer than 5 seconds so that he can't see the future event and what the move is going to be. So it actually makes it more fun and interesting for him than the chess boxing, which I think he does to make money, right? Like that's part of how he lives in New York City in a relatively nice apartment, et cetera.
Right. And gambling, right. There are certain kinds of gambling where you have an immediate enough of feedback that, that it works with his particular gift.
So if I may,
yes, please.
The thing that drew me in, I mean, there were definitely some interesting details in that first chapter, but the train bit, which I'm not even sure if it happened in the first chapter, there were the mood or the tone felt very 80s and like Bernard Goetz. I don't know if you all remember, he was like a vigilante shooter and it's all very sus because, you know, it's the 80s. But there, the mood, even though I know it's taking place in current or like slightly future, the bit where he's on the train and the cops approach him and the train's empty and the advertising, and he's just minding his own business, but he's being a smart aleck, just felt very like setting up an 80s movie. Mm-hmm. So that's what pulled me in.
Yeah. For me, I like it when an author talks about a book, like a character in a book, taking the author someplace. And this book feels like an example of that, where, because it's so contingent just upon him, like you said, being a smartass on the subway. And it's contingent upon a thing that happens in real life, where a cop who's too big for his britches gets his feelings hurt and decides, I'm going to violate somebody's rights. I'm going to go over here and say that he's breaking the law by putting his bag in a seat. Which is technically against the rules, but it's a pretextual stop, right? And now I'm going to be like, give me your ID. You know, I'm going to rough you up a little bit. And for whatever reason, Preble is like, I'm not doing this today, and decides to try and get his way out of it. And then all of a sudden he sees, oh, this is going to go spectacularly wrong. And there's not a whole lot I can do about that other than protect myself. Mm-hmm. And that's where it kicks off into this, the kind of weapons that are used against him are going to be used against who's ever coming against him. And like JW mentioned earlier, where he's like, I think one of the first things happens is one of the cops who approaches him gets badly wounded, and he realizes, oh crap, she's going to die if I don't help. And so he radios it in and is like, and by the way, don't bring any guns against me. That's stupid. And this, of course, yeah, that all spirals out of control and leads to Thad Bigman, realizing that there's something up here. I did want to talk real quick about, are there any other books that this reminded you of? For me, the one it reminded me most of was Jumper by Stephen Gould. Not the movie, the book. Just because it's somebody kind of, at least in that one, it's more of a, like almost like a superhero origin story, where this is something where it's somebody who knows about his abilities and generally tries to keep it to himself. Mm-hmm. But it's, The similarity is, you know, the government starts to realize, hey, that kid who's from this little place in Pennsylvania was in Dubai 2 hours ago, and that's not possible. Where here, it's more just like the security cameras and stuff kind of reveal how he moves, and that's when they realize something's weird here. And of course, the big government guy is going to step in and go, how can we use this?
I can't think of anything I read that's similar. Okay. And it certainly feels more of a thriller style book. I don't read a lot of thrillers.
Yeah. In terms of where would you, I could definitely see people saying, oh, this isn't even science fiction. It's it's a literature book, but I'm not totally sure about that. Of course, I'm also suspicious of people not liking the label science fiction.
Yeah. There is sort of like a genre bias that happens. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I would definitely label this science fiction. I could see, you know, it blurs the line, right? Mm-hmm. It sits on the line between like a thriller, like picking up, you know, I'm not going to be really remember any off the top of my head, but picking up a thriller, which I read occasionally, and believe it or not, and, you know, science fiction, especially later on when they start to explain how he sees the 5 seconds in the future and what's going on there. Like, that's very next to hard sci-fi, right? Where you're talking real science, quote unquote, real, you know, science being applied.
Yeah.
There. So I think, you know, but I think this is one of those books that could be sort of a gateway either for fans of science fiction to jump in and enjoy some thriller type novels or vice versa. Now, Blake Crouch is the comp that I would kind of think of, where a lot of his books have that thriller vibe to them. But also like The Bourne Identity and that kind of thing, where it's like this escalating level of involvement from the government, who ends up being sort of the bad guys and maybe also the good guys, depending on what you're looking at and what perspective you have.
Yeah. And coming after somebody who turns out to be super deadly.
Right. Those would be some of my comps.
Yeah. For this. I mean, like the most direct comparison, I think, is The Golden Man, the Philip K. Dick story of the precognitive character. Right. And that was adapted into the extremely mediocre Nicolas Cage movie Next. Right. I did like, there's one point where they're going into like a warehouse and it shows him searching the entire warehouse by like stepping to a junction, and one version of his consciousness goes, you know, 60 seconds in that direction, another goes 60 seconds in the other. And this book kind of grabs some of that. I'm thinking we should probably go into spoilers.
Sure.
I guess let's just go ahead and sum up. Like, if did we like the book? Sophia, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, I loved it.
Okay.
I loved it. I mean, there were some, okay. I loved it for what it was. There were definitely one, you know, now that it's been a few weeks, a few things that, oh, like that person, like the wife is a little flat.
Yeah.
But it's okay. But, you know, she did her job in the book. But even at the end where you get the kid more fleshed out, I mean, that was very interesting for me because had the author not done that, it would have been a very flat, a mom and child.
Put a pin in that about the kid, because I want to definitely talk about that in spoilers.
Yeah. I thought we were spoiling.
No, we're not quite there. It's okay. You're good. I did mention spoilers. This is what happens. I mention a point we're going to get to and then realize we haven't quite gotten there. This is the way I do things. JW, what'd you think of this one overall?
I liked it quite a bit. I have some pretty heavy caveats with that, which we'll get into in the spoilers. But I think I can do this without spoilers. Like, I think thematically it had a lot more going on than a lot of novels of this sort do. You already kind of mentioned with like the police too big for their britches type of thing, but there's a juxtaposition there, right? Cause it's not just this, there's definitely like the skepticism of the state and skepticism of state violence and skepticism of arming this ever increasing amount of armament of the police and ability to in do violence. Right. But there's also, right at the very beginning, it's page 2. I looked it up earlier, where Preble talks about his wife Jane and how she feels very comforted by having these police going around in the neighborhood and having them just show up randomly on the train. And there's multiple times where that juxtaposition happens, where there's this sense of like we're supposed to be made safe by this entity and by these people, and yet obviously there's a ton of lack of safety that happens throughout the entire novel with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that thread, among others, which we're going to do in the spoilers, but I think it really makes the book juicier than it was. If it had just ended up being a chase novel, it would have been a pretty solid chase novel, but it gets beyond that. So to me, it was like sort of like in that, it wasn't quite like my spectacular, you know, 5 out of 5, but it was up there. And I think I could see where it wins the Locus, which, again, not a spoiler, but it only has like 90 reviews on Storygraph, for example. Like, I'm still like really surprised. This book came out of left field, so I'm curious how it got on that list.
Well, there's not even an audiobook for it yet. I think it got the audiobook off of winning the Locus.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't come out until September. Because I was on our email thread. I was like, or we could punt this one down to September and and I can pick up the audiobook and review it. But yeah, it's like in terms of the plot, it can be enjoyed just as a chase novel. Like you said, it can be enjoyed on the plot and the little science fiction trappings of how does this gift work. But then the thematic stuff kind of makes it a little deeper. It's not the cheeriest book I've ever read, certainly. Now, Sophia, we're going to get into spoilers for real this time. and I do want to talk about Casper because there was... So let's talk about the chase though, right? So it went on so long, just the initial chase, because it basically goes through the entire city because they just keep mobilizing and mobilizing, and then there's a little bit of a break, and then we're back to big chases with drones and I think it was a drone, wasn't it?
Some kind of aircraft, helicopter.
Helicopter.
Yeah.
And they actually like launched a missile. And I mean, again, like I thought that part was well done too, because there was a sense of like, they're going to escalate this. How can they escalate it? And shooting a missile in the middle of New York City, you know, having the president basically sign off on like, yeah, we can blow up a bridge to take this guy out. Like that's
right.
You know,
right. And that's the first hint of later escalation even further. Right.
Right. And it felt like, the way that the author sold it felt like it wasn't unrealistic usually. And again, big asterisk there in my mind, but usually it felt like you could almost see this like, hey, this guy's dangerous. Here's what's going on. And you could see someone who's not necessarily in on exactly the consequences of all this, because you can't anticipate all the consequences, obviously.
Right.
Thinking like, well, yeah, we got to take him out. So sacrificing, you know, 2,000 New Yorkers with some missile into an apartment building is fine. Obviously, you know, I think that number's inflated, but
I mean, thank you for bringing that up. It's a similar thinking from Preble's side in that he's okay sacrificing people to save his wife and son.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me that, like, you know, if you, it's not a pure good guy, bad guy situation. Right, like, mm-hmm. they're all bad.
They're all kind of, yeah, it's like in True Lies.
Or they're all good yeah. because they, you know, there is a logic to why they're doing what they're doing. Yeah. But ultimately, the body count is high.
And, the body count is real high. Yeah.
And at some point, Preble does not care.
Yeah, right. And I feel like that was, up until his family was taken, right, he was trying to protect life as much as possible. And the initial, I think there was a death that he tried to avoid in yep. the initial chase. And then turned out, no, he couldn't avoid it. And it was, you know, it was because he was running and people were chasing him, right? There were two sides of that. But it made me think of, do you know what Freeman's Mind is? Have you ever played Half-Life?
No.
There's a machinima, which is where somebody plays through a game as the point of view character and makes kind of plots up as they go. And in that game, at some point, the government soldiers start coming in trying to suppress everything, to kill anybody who knows about it. And so he's fighting back and he's shooting these soldiers. Then later in the game, he's like, I don't know, man, you know, it's going to be harder and harder to explain several dozen cases of self-defense. if I ever get indicted for this. And that's kind of where it got pretty quickly with Preble, where it's like, you know, reckless endangerment, lots of charges that you're getting on yourself. Which just from a couple flip comments and one look that a policeman misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. But so let's talk about a little bit about the way his ability works, because it's not exactly, I see what will happen in 5 seconds, right? He can more or less roll through and see the outcome that he wants and then work backwards from that. And that was a really interesting concept.
Is that what it was saying? Because I honestly, I'm not sure I quite caught it that way. So you're saying,
yeah. So he was talking about like when he's doing, when he's having to shoot at someone, right. He can just basically see the version of his future where he hits his target and then work backwards from that.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yes. And so the same thing with combinations or nuclear codes or anything like that, right? He can kind of see in everything that could happen in 5 seconds and then spin it back.
The possible future.
Yeah.
Right. Which is how they get past the, like, it would take more than five seconds to see all of these possibilities. Like,
He doesn't have to go through them one at a time. Exactly. Right. But, it also makes it so that there are, like, if there was a lock that had a 10-second lockout every time you tried a combination, even if it was successful, he can't see that one, right?
Right.
I guess
at one point he.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I guess it would be possible for him to see the future where he got it on the first try. But no, because the 10 seconds would still get him. Yeah.
And there's one point where, you know, he is talking to, I think, the president, you know, when they're all locked up in a room together. And, you know, they're like, well, you can just anticipate what I'm going to say anyway. He's like, you could always just keep lying. You know, like he's basically trying to give them a give me, like, you know, you don't actually have to tell me the truth. I can just see, you know, what you're going to say. And if mm-hmm. you're just lying.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Well, there's even the little minor thing about, like, his wife realizes that he always knows the thing to say to keep her from really getting mad at him.
Right. Yeah. And like, that would be tough on the relationship. And
yeah, I feel like all husbands have a little bit of a sense of that, but it's not finely tuned enough. Yeah, the way he makes money, right? He said he does gambling on roulette. Was that what mm-hmm. it was?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he tries not to draw too much attention.
So that's one of my caveats, actually, because the way it's written. So, I mean, this is one of those novels, as many are, especially in science fiction, where you can just, like, if you pull out some of the threads, it comes apart, right?
Yeah.
And that was one that I was willing to suspend my disbelief for a lot of the stuff, but that one I struggled with because it's like there's a Roald Dahl short story, and I forget what it's called now, but it's about a guy who basically can, like, see through the backs of cards. And so he goes to gambling and he's able to see through. And he kind of realizes that, like, you have to lose sometimes because otherwise they're on your trail. And it's like all Preble does is win every time. Like, in fact, they basically say, like, the IRS is all over him. You know, all these places are trying to figure out how he does it. He just shows up, you know, he wins like $80,000 or whatever. I forget what his limit is that he imposes on himself. And he leaves, and it's like, yeah, obviously they're going to be on to you at some point. And
I mean, I feel like he came to that realization at some point that I probably should have been more careful. I should have done more losing.
Yeah.
There was a short film that was nominated for an Academy Award based on that story, the Roald Dahl one, The Wonderful Life of Somebody. I can't remember what it was. Oh. Had Benedict Cumberbatch in it.
Do you recall before the whole, like, his world blows up and he's on the run, does he ever talk about using his power for good? I'm doing air quotes.
Yeah, I remember it coming up as like sort of almost like a regret, right? Because yeah, he could cure cancer, right? He could, if there are tests that could be done that could produce results in a quick enough time frame, right? He could be the ultimate trial tester, essentially. But he can't do that without drawing attention. And so that's why he's never done it.
Yeah. So this is what makes me think that he's supposed to be a complicated bad guy or just a bad guy, because there are things he could have done prior to the incident with the police to improve his world, his community, but he kept his powers to himself and he used it to make money, which is fine. We all use our powers to make money, but for him, it was a quick means, and it wasn't to make the world a better place until he was backed into a corner and he used it as a bargaining chip for his family.
Right. Because that's what we come to, kind of the big confrontation between the big organization trying to find him, big man, right? And he's trying to figure out, how do I come out of this alive and with my family intact? And he says, look, just find me an island someplace. I'll go there. I'll do all the scientific research. You have to give me all your nukes first. so that I can launch them if I need to, which is horrifying.
Doesn't he just ask for enough nukes to also be a threat?
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, and it turns, this is where, like, I think the novel, it will either really work for some people or really go off the rails, because it almost turns into, it's very similar to like a Red Scare novel out of like the 50s and 60s, where it's like, it basically turns into like a standoff, you know, nuclear escalation when you have, you know, all these higher ups getting involved. And, you know, I don't know. I've let it work for me, I guess, again, sort of like the suspending disbelief, but it escalated so quickly to that point that I was kind of like, oh, okay. All right.
That's why they call it the nuclear option, JW.
I guess.
It kind of reminded me a little bit of like Failsafe for Red Alert. One of those novels about brinkmanship. Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, with how Preble's, stuff works, you know, all the discussion of how it's actually like a variant on, is it the whatever part of the brain, you know, basically that like it's because quote unquote normal humans can only, you know, we try to predict people's facial expressions and emotions, but he has this gene that had a modification is the wrong word, a mutation where he has like, isn't it like a double, like doubled it or something?
Something. Is it the hippocampus?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so one thing I definitely wanted to just bring up is like, not only, you know, does he kind of go from a sympathetic protagonist to possibly a villain and possibly a terrible villain, but also like there's that question of, is he actually a different species, right? Like, and
yes.
And is Big Man right that there is an inevitability of this explosion, whether it's him or someone related to him, ultimately, that like it's gonna set something off and basically burn the world in some way. And right, so
and the history of science fiction is filled with stuff like that, like SLAN, right? Like going way back in science fiction and just talking about the evolution of the human species into something new.
Yeah. And so like is Big Man, I mean, Big Man is definitely a villain for sure, but is he wrong all the time? Possibly not. And is it just that there would have eventually been a Big Man? There would have eventually been a cop who looked at him the wrong way, because I think it isn't it Big Man who points that out at some point. He's like, basically like, the whole reason we're on this is because, you know, you got upset that someone looked at you the wrong way. Imagine that kind of power that isn't checked by anything. And that's what they're trying to prevent is, hey, if we have this species or this person or this group of people who can just do this, like, yeah, everyone has to be watching their backs all the time, because what if you look at them the wrong way or you sneeze at the wrong time? So
that's why we need stable, good people to be in government leadership.
Yes, that's definitely the takeaway here.
Yeah, Yeah. Okay. So I want to work us over to talking about the son. So after kind of all this kicks off, he finds Fish, his anarchist friend, who tells him, look, we've got a cabin out in the weeds in Canada, off the grid. Go there, hide out for as long as you need. And that's where they kind of have their little, it reminded me of Firestarter, if you ever read that from Stephen King, where there's a portion of the book where the Firestarter protagonist and her father are in a cabin across a lake. And that kind of reminded me of that. But that's where we get the first little hint that there's something with Casper, because he says something about a bear.
That's right.
Did you guys pick up on that when it happened?
I knew there was something, but I did not. I assumed he was just more sensitive, like a sensitive child.
Okay. So because he said something about, you know, well, the bear will hurt you a little bit. And it's just this kind of like mysterious things that kids say sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It set me off just very slightly in the moment. And then obviously, like, after finishing the novel, that's when I was like, ah, yeah, that's definitely,
yeah,
I can see where that was sort of planted.
It kind of put my spidey sense up for the rest of the book. And I was worried that it was going to lead to a really crappy ending to the novel, where everything that happened up until the end of the book was precognition from Casper. And it was going to be terrible. One of the Twilight movies, I think, did something like that, where they're like, there's this huge battle and they're like, and that's what would have happened, but we're not going to do that.
I'm glad that's not what it was.
Yeah, I was glad too.
That would piss me off.
Yeah, I like for a novel to play fair. And so that's like why I prefer the ending in the book of The Edge of Tomorrow. It's quite different anyway, but I don't mind the ending being a little bit of a downer, there being a cost to winning the war, where in the movie, it's like, it's a little too neat, but I still do like it. That's another precognition story.
So. I do like both the novel and the movie of that one.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, very, very different feel. So Casper, I don't know how far ahead we want to jump with him, but not just that he obviously has the gift, but that he is able to see, you know, years into the future. You know, like, I think it's close to the last line of the book where he's like, don't worry, when I'm 17, you know, I'll meet the bad guys and I'll defeat them. It's like, oh my gosh. So, you know, how far ahead is he able to see? And does he have another mutation? Or is it just that from birth he realized differently how the gift was working, or what have you? And I mean, do you two see this? I'm curious, like, do you two see this as a hopeful ending for the world? Or is it really just an even scarier ending than it would have been if they had just nuked everybody and that's the end? Because initially I thought the ending was just everybody got nuked, the end. But it's not, right? You have Casper out there saying, I'm going to beat the bad guys. But who are the bad guys to him? And, you know, is he going to be a good person in the future? I don't know. Did you see it as hopeful?
No. I saw the ending as dark and not hopeful and not optimistic. I'm projecting a little bit, but for me, Fish being the most sympathetic and likable character of the bunch, and him being an anarchist, I'm thinking that it is an analog for the author and his maybe projecting that the government is not to be trusted. So when Casper comments about getting his revenge, I absolutely see it as an anti-government, I'm going to teach you all a lesson when I'm old enough.
Yes.
Right, like it's a supervillain origin story.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, it was so like, but so great. It was so great.
Maybe we'll get a Brightburn-style sequel, but that's an actually good movie, because Brightburn was not.
I was generally wondering if there is possibly a sequel in the works. I mean, I didn't see anything about it, but, you know, who knows if it's getting more, you know, traction under it.
I think, Sophia, you mentioned that, you know, the 5 seconds sounds reasonable, right? It's quite powerful, but whatever Casper has, it's a different level.
Oh, yeah. I don't even know. Well, I'm not a writer, but I think it would be, it's like the world is too expansive, or your power is too expansive. And these tight sort of like rules, I think, makes for some very interesting like plot story devices.
Yeah. Even like in the Dune series, right? There's the whole idea of the golden path and the precognition and you know, all these terrible things that come about because of of Paul Atreides, right? And his ability to see into the future. But he also causes a lot of those terrible things to happen. And yeah, Casper could definitely go that direction. Mm-hmm. I'd be curious if there would be a sequel of, you know, winning the Nebula and then, you know, maybe it starts doing well. Maybe it accrues more reviews and who knows. Publishers can get sequels greenlit pretty easily, I think.
I mean, I would be interested in a sequel, but yeah, I agree with Sophia. I think it would be incredibly difficult to do it at all for the author. I mean, like, how do you play with someone who can see that far in the future? It's like, it would almost get boring for Casper, right? Like, if you assume he's like a real person and treat him like a real person, like, mm-hmm. what do you even do at that point?
Yeah, do you go to school and hang out in the schoolyard?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure how you'd execute that. Go ahead.
So was it, for you, the ending, what was your take on it? Awful, dark.
Yeah, I thought it was a mixture. You could kind of see it either direction, where it's, you know, the triumph of the essentially innocent character, right, of Casper, because none of this is his fault, and I did read it as dark, right? You know, I'm gonna come into my own. I'm gonna rise up and defeat the bad guys. It's just a question of who the bad guys are at that point, like JW was saying. Because if it's the entire U.S. government, then that, you know, yeah.
And I think that he really nailed the ending in this one, because I think it would have worked if it had been left with just like a sort of nuclear holocaust. If that had been like the ending, I think it would have worked. But this was sort of the only way he could have Casper and Jane survive, mm-hmm. and make it still interesting, because it really is. Either it's a really hopeful and excellent future in our quote unquote future, or it's just a horrible reality that's coming, and we don't know. And I like that ambiguity at the end. I don't always, but it worked really well in this novel.
Yeah. I don't have a strong memory of the ending other than the line from the kid. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was trying to think of it today and I was like, oh, that's right. There's that super dark possible line. But like, I don't remember what happened to Preble. So
there you are. I think he's dead.
Yeah. He got nuked.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. That's how I interpreted it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I did go back and reread that section because I wasn't sure. I was like, did the nukes actually fall? And it's like, well, yeah, he talks about, oh no, I'm actually feeling myself die because.
Right.
Because remember, right. He's able to push his future vision out a little farther. I don't remember exactly how far he gets, but.
Yeah, he talks about expanding his window.
Seconds, right? And basically to the point where like he's actually like feeling his particles all dissolve in mm-hmm. every future. And it's like, oh yeah, like this is the end.
I'm dead. Yeah.
I don't know how I forgot that, because that was very evocative. I remember when I was reading it. So this is what happens when I was legitimately today, I was like, we're podcasting in 3 hours. I was like, oh no, that's it's like in 15 minutes. So I was going to pick up the book. I was just going to buy the ebook and review it a little bit, but didn't get to do it. That's okay. That's why I have you two here.
I mean, I remember quite a bit, and I do legit love the cat and mouse chase. Mm-hmm. And the frostbite.
God, oh, yeah.
So visceral.
Yeah, it was.
That frostbite part. Oh, gosh. I
feel like that was trying to make you realize this character is not, you know, omniscient, right? Like, he did a really dumb thing. He was impulsive, right? He's trying to find his son. And there's a point that feels really tragic where you're like, did everybody fall through the ice and die? And that would have been really, really sad.
Yeah.
I felt like the book played fair about that, which I was glad. One thing that I had to credit, and I put it on the Discord, was that he describes blood tasting like iron.
Yes.
Because so many authors keep saying that blood tastes like copper. And I'm like, is everybody sucking on pennies around here when they're kids?
Give credit where it's due.
Yeah.
Give credit where it's due.
Like, you know, the universal experience is you bite your lip and you taste blood, and blood tastes like blood. So I don't know why we need to add adjectives for certain things in books, but everybody needs to do it.
There was another detail that I picked up. It was so subtle, and I'm going to butcher the wording, but I only noticed this because I had you know, gone to India for work. Mm. And there's this sort of this like head nod shake that they do to sort of acknowledge, you know. And it was in the book. And I was like, how did he get that in there, you know? Mm. I was really impressed that he dedicated, I mean, just a couple of words, but enough to be like, if you know it, if you've seen it, you know it, you picked up on it.
Okay, nice.
So
being from Alaska, I picked up on the, you know, the thousands and thousands of mosquito bites that they got. And yes. I had never really heard of the thing that, like, if you get enough mosquito bites in a short enough period of time, you will actually become immune. But it's not going to be a real fun couple of weeks while you're doing that. I looked it up. There's a SciShow episode that talks about it and like how many you need to get. It's thousands over the course of weeks. And I'm already like, I don't know if they like my O positive blood or what, but boy, the mosquitoes love me.
Well, I've heard that Congaree National Park is good for mosquitoes, and eventually I want to try to hit every national park. So maybe I'll try for the immunity there.
Where's that one?
North Carolina.
Okay.
It's like famous for, they have like a clock that has the times are just different levels of mosquito present. So
nice. Yeah. Around here where I live, they seem to come out like right at dusk. And that's, that's when they're bad. And so like, and it's like optimum time to be sitting out on my back patio. And then I'm like, oh, mosquitoes, I guess I'm going in now.
I'm not a fan.
No.
And I don't have O positive blood, and they love me as well.
All right. Good.
We haven't mentioned Fish that much. I know we've kind of talked about how much we like him as a character, but having this sort of like anarchist who's also a lawyer, because like that's how he makes his living. Like,
right.
A lot of the lines that he had and a lot of the thoughts that Preble had from conversations from Fish were what drove my interest in both characters. Mm. About, I want to say it's like maybe a third or halfway through the book, there's this discussion of like the necessity in common law and like how it still exists, but like punishment has ramped up so much. So like there's more, it's this line that's basically like, there's more punishment for stealing bread to survive than there is for stealing millions of dollars from their shareholders. Mm. And I just, there's a lot of lines like that in there. And I'm like, is this Fish talking or is this the author? Because you know, it's so pointed and it's so on the nose, but it's so well integrated into the story that it never felt like overbearing. And I already talked about like thematically, like the juxtaposition of the police violence versus police protection. And I think like it was just really well done in a way that I wouldn't normally expect for a thriller. But anyway, so for Fish, like what are your Fish thoughts? Like I know Sophia mentioned as a favorite character.
Yeah, I love him. Well, and he even mentions, you know, in the story, he's held for months and he's tortured. And we don't really get much into it, but just we get enough to know, like, government sucks. You know, we get just enough.
Oh, I totally forgot that scene.
Didn't he have a line where, like, he's like, I was going to tell him seven lies and then I was going to tell him the truth or something. Like that. I can't remember what the number was.
There was some number of saved up lies and he's like, and they stopped after whatever.
Yeah, so
they
never that was his tactic, though, to be like, okay, I'm going to resist, and then I'm going to tell him something bogus. And then, I thought that was
so
that was
good. Yeah. I would like a book about just Fish, honestly.
Yeah, it is interesting. He's almost like the Ron Swanson character, right? Where Ron Swanson is here ahead of a government department, but anti-government. Yep. So he's a lawyer, but anti-establishment.
And I don't remember his last name, but he's got this crazy long last name.
I wrote it down. Did you? It's Robert Legmegbetegget Det Beckneck. And it's basically like, it like actually means something, and obviously I slaughtered it, so apologies to whoever knows what that means, but it's something about like being sick and not being sick or something like that.
And it was in just like a one-liner. Do you know?
I'm curious. Is that a Slovak name?
I'll have to find it again. Hungarian. The Hungarian word meant the sickest, but since was nearly unpronounceable by anyone other than another Hungarian, since he was only 5'5", and since he styled himself after Bobby Fischer, he'd gone through some nickname drift from Little Fisher to Little Fish to just Fish.
That's great. Oh my gosh.
It was just a fun little, I mean, basically everything about Fish is something that I enjoy. And just a great character.
Yeah, good stuff.
So with the sort of like play of, you know, good guy, bad guy, Fish, I think, is the only one who is just, I don't think he's morally ambiguous. Mm. I think he's clearly meant to be a good guy through and through.
Yeah, I think that. I think that's accurate. And you know, Jane, we've talked about, you know, if there's a fault here, it's the female characters aren't well employed or they don't have a lot to do. And there's really just one of them. So book doesn't really pass the Bechdel test, which is a pretty low bar to clear. You know, she's not precisely innocent, right? Because she's standing behind this guy who's been doing some pretty terrible things. And maybe at some point she could have said, you should just turn yourself in. But then, you know, she wasn't going to do that. And here's somebody that she loves, then she doesn't want to see put in a deep hole someplace and studied for the rest of his life. Because like JW was saying, if there's really a brain or abnormality here or something that can be something in his DNA that could be teased out, you know, this could be pretty useful.
And he does turn himself in. Yeah. He's just not successful.
Right, right. He manages to kill a lot of people while trying to turn himself in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and honestly, like one of the better, I mean, there's a lot of really good action scenes. So when I say better, I mean good of many, but I think that was one of the best action scenes too, where it's like the tension ramped up so much as he turned himself in, because like you as a reader are like, how's this going to go? Like right. there's a lot more book left.
Yeah.
But also, you know, you just know something's going to go wrong. And you know, as I think is a normal response, like all the police officers are going to be like, this guy injured whatever 40 something officers and ended up like three or whatever died from various wounds. And it's like, yeah, they're going to be amped up and they're going to go after him. And so mm-hmm. it just, the tension builds and the way that he builds the tension is just, it's so good.
Yeah. Yeah. And at some point he's like, okay, I'm only going to hurt the people on the left side. I'm going to spare everybody on the right. The other interesting thing, like the outworking of his power, right, is his fear of elevators, because of course, you know, elevators are slow and
I love so that
kind of black boxes to him.
He says that at the end, like as he's dying. In fact, that's like one of the last thoughts they put in is I always thought it would be on an elevator.
Right.
That's great.
Yeah. Interesting book. You know, I wasn't totally sure how I felt about it when I finished it, but I it was compelling. And I was like, I got to get a couple other people to read this just so I can find out how I feel about it. That often happens when I'm new to finishing a book, takes me a while to kind of settle on it, and always having a discussion helps with that. So thank you guys. Any final thoughts, Sophia?
My aunt does not love sci-fi, but loves thrillers. So I'm going to try to get her to read this one.
All right. You have to report to us on the Discord if that works.
She's very picky.
You don't have any social media that you want to give out, right?
I mean, I'm on LinkedIn, but this is not my world. I'm truly a fan. Nice.
We can point people over to the Discord if you're somebody who's interested in reading the winners of the Nebula and the Hugo. It's a really fun community there. I do a lot of lurking because I don't always have the bandwidth that I'd like to participate in the monthly reads and the all the polls, and there's buddy reads as well. So it's really cool. If you want a link to it, just reach out to me. I can get you a Discord invite. And you can find me there. You can find Sophia as well. Do you want to give out your handle there in case anybody wants to say hello?
Bike Muffin 1000.
Nice. And JW, you are on there as Bonhoeffer fan?
No, I think I am actually on there as JW Wartig. I just figured it's a small enough group. And I mean, I love sci-fi, so I'm happy to talk about it with people with all my name. So
I must be thinking of another place where that's your username.
Yeah.
Nice. Final thoughts from you?
I think that this could not only be a gateway to sci-fi, but also a gateway to thriller from the other direction, where mm-hmm. sci-fi fans who enjoy, you know, whether it's hard sci-fi or nuke novels or whatever, obviously a lot of that stuff happens later, but could get into thrillers this way. I think it's one of those where talking about it means I like sort of helped me like it even more. I was mm-hmm. like, I liked it, but now that we've talked about it, I'm like, yeah, this one's going to stick with me for a while. There's a lot of scenes that I remember.
Yeah.
So I would highly recommend it.
Well, I might keep an eye out for that audiobook when it comes out in September and give it a reread that way, just to listen to how everything's pronounced and find out if we got Preble correct. and listen to the audiobook narrator have to tackle that Hungarian last name as well.
Yeah.
That'd be fun. So, all right. Well, this is kind of, I think it's going to end up sort of a lean episode, you know, 45 minutes or so, but it was really cool to talk about a more recent book than I generally talk about, except when I'm doing like awards panels and that kind of stuff. So thank you so much for doing this. Thanks, Sophia.
Thank you, Seth.
Yep. Good to see you again. Thanks, JW.
Thank you.
And I'm sure this will come out after we've actually met in person at WorldCon this year.
Yeah.
So
you're both awesome. Attending?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And then for everybody out there listening, let us know. Have you read this book? What'd you think of it? And hit us up on that Discord if you're interested in really cool hangouts and talking about books and, you know, photos of dogs and off-topic stuff as well. It's a lot of fun over there. All right. Bye.
Thank you.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.